with members of both parties. Congressman Ryan's budget promises to cut spending by $4.5 trillion over the next decade, leading to a balanced budget without raising taxes. Senator Patty Murray's plan does not balance the budget, but does include mostly equal amounts of spending cuts and tax increases that would reduce the amount of government borrowing. So today in Radio Times, we get two perspectives on these plans on economic growth, tax reform, jobs, government spending, and more. Let me introduce them to you. Joining us by telephone is Michael Tanner. He's senior fellow with the Cato Institute, architect of the Cato's Project on Social Security Choice. He writes a weekly column for National Review Online, a contributing columnist with the New York Post. Michael Tanner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a real pleasure.
Also with us is Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was, until recently, the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. And Jared Bernstein joining us from the studios of the Center. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Jared Bernstein, let me begin with you. How big a problem is deficit spending as you see it?
Well, right now, it's not that big a problem. In fact, the budget deficit was 10% of GDP a few years ago. Now it's 5%. So it's come down considerably as the Great Recession is in the rearview window. Recessions, by their nature, increase spending in what we call stabilizers, that is, things like unemployment insurance and food stamp benefits that go up in recession. And that increases the budget deficit, while that increases government outlays, while taxes paid go down because people are doing less well. So as the economy has improved, that situation has gotten better as well. So really, there's no debt or deficit emergency in the near or medium term. But if you go out enough years, you do see pressures from health care costs such that the debt would be rising faster than the economy. So in the long term, that's what we have to wrestle with.
And I do want to get to that, but let me give you a chance, Michael Tanner, to respond as well. Do you see a debt or deficit emergency as you look at the U.S. economy?
Well, I think I'm actually not going to disagree all that much. In the short term, the deficit is down. It does continue to decline over the next couple of years. It'll bottom up out at around $545 billion around 2015 or 2016 or so. But it then begins to rise thereafter. And out by 2023, we're back coming closer to $1 trillion deficits again. The fact is, in the long run, we have a tremendous debt problem, and the debts that are, you know, we're already over 103% of GDP in our debt, which is over the limit when it starts to slow economic growth. So I think we have a debt problem that's bad and getting worse, and a deficit problem that's not immediate, but going to start up again pretty soon.
Michael Tanner, let me ask you, though, should the goal of government be a balanced budget? Does that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, I think it's better balanced than not balanced. But no, I think the big question is not whether the government is balanced. It's the size of government. As Milton Friedman used to say, the real cost of government isn't debt or taxes, it's spending. And the fact is, whether you pay for that through debt or you pay for it through taxes, you're still extracting resources from the private sector, and in the long run, you cannot support a government that's going to be at the size that we're projecting this government to be.
Same question to you, Jared Bernstein. Should the goal be a balanced budget? Does that make sense to you?
Now, this is very efficient from you. You just get the same question, and
we will develop this, but go
no,
ahead.
No, I'm teasing.
Okay.
Now, interestingly, Michael and I are, you know, finding a fair bit to agree on, although we definitely come at this from different directions, particularly when it comes to just our views on how much spending an economy like this really needs. So, you know, that's where we would differ. But the idea that you kind of have to pay for what you spend, I think, is just common sense. Look, it's good that Michael doesn't argue for a balanced budget, especially in the near term, because, again, our biggest deficit right now is a jobs deficit, not a budget deficit. So we have to be mindful of not going down this austere road that has led to double-dip recessions in Europe. I think the goal should be to stabilize the debt as a share of the economy. By that, I mean the following. Every year that the debt grows faster than the underlying GDP, we devote more and more of our economy to servicing the debt, to paying off the debt, to having to worry about debt and deficits. So when you're looking at a very tough economy like we were in the Great Recession, it makes all the sense in the world for your deficits and debt to grow then, because you have to offset this large contraction in demand. But as the economy gets better, you want that to start coming down. So that means stabilizing the debt so that it grows slower than the economy. It doesn't mean balancing. Right now, we're about $1.5 trillion away from stabilizing the debt as a share of GDP over the next decade. That's about 0.5% of GDP over that period. So that's not that heavy a lift.
To you, Michael Tanner, though, how then does the United States grow its economy?
Well, I think what you want to do is take your foot off the brakes. And here is where we disagree. I think that it is the level of government spending, and therefore the level of resources that are extracted from the private sector, that slows growth. You know, Jared just mentioned the fact that Europe's teetering towards double-dip recession. But for all the talk of austerity in Europe, there's actually been remarkably little reduction in government spending. What there has been is heavy tax increases. Most of these austerity programs in countries like Britain and Spain and Greece are actually heavy tax increases, and that has slowed economic growth. So when we start hearing about $1 trillion in new taxes, for example, in the Murray budget, that we have to look at as a potential stopping on the brakes of economic growth.
Well, let me pick up on that, and let me ask you about military spending. If the government were to reduce the amount of money that it spends on defense, would the private sector step in, Michael Tanner?
Well, no, but much of the money we spend on defense doesn't do anything to increase productivity or increase economic growth. You know, one of the most foolish things the Republicans do is they pretend that cutting government bureaucracy in other areas, they're correct in it. It doesn't have any effect on long-term economic growth. But then they turn around and they say that military spending does. They're wrong. You know, government spending, whether it's on domestic spending or military spending, has about the same impact.
Well, I'm asking you the same question again, Jared Bernstein. But what we have also learned about, at least Pentagon spending, is that there are contracts in just about every district in this country. There are jobs associated with defense spending. How does the country deal with that?
I remember when I was a student of public finance in college, there was a little cartoon in one of my textbooks, and it had a picture of a fighter jet that said, this is the perfect weapon, insulated from every attack, and it showed a little arrow to every state which builds each piece of this fighter jet. So that's sort of a public finance joke.
No, I get it, and I can see it. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, one factual disagreement with Michael. In fact, at least I know the UK, for example, has done actually more in terms of spending cuts than tax increases. So we just have there is spending austerity, at least in the UK. I don't disagree that the defense spending, as Michael described it, is certainly one piece that should be, in fact, and is on the table in terms of spending cuts in ways that we haven't seen in the past. And perhaps Michael's group has had some impact on this. It used to be the case that Republicans stood firm against any defense cuts. Now, and interestingly, the Democrats thought that would be the case. That's one of the reasons why they had this thought the sequester would work, because they thought Republicans would run from the idea of cutting spending on defense. But in fact, some Republicans have agreed to that. Now, we can argue about the magnitude of the cuts, but defense is on the table.
Well, and going back to you, Michael Tanner, if defense is on the table, and we did end one war where it looks like winding down a second war, but we've got the costs of veterans coming back from those wars. There are, of course, questions about whether we need military bases around the country. Is all that on the table for discussion from your perspective?
Oh, absolutely. It certainly should be. I say one of the things that I thought was a step forward is it looks like in the Ryan budget is that he finally is willing to accept caps on defense spending, which is something Republicans have resisted in the past. I think there's still much too much defense spending in the Ryan budget. But part of it is you need to decide, not sort of arbitrarily decide how much you're going to cut from defense. What you need to do is change the strategy. We need to spend as much on defense as defense requires. You don't want to just send soldiers into battle with fewer bullets. So what we should be doing is looking at our strategy, which should not be endless war around the world.
Well, to you, Jared Bernstein, and looking ahead, even looking to things like entitlements, we've got, of course, baby boomers retiring, which, of course, raises questions about Medicare. How do you think Medicare can be sustained looking forward?
I think that the way to sustain Medicare looking forward is to make sure that we protect those aspects of the program that are working great, which I would argue are most of the program, and try to fix the ones that are not working so well. Interestingly, the latter includes lots of problems in healthcare delivery that are unique to the United States and by no means unique to Medicare. That is both, it's even worse in the private sector. That is, healthcare costs grow a lot faster in the private sector than they do in Medicare, but they grow too fast in Medicare as well. So we need to figure out ways to slow the growth of spending on medical care, and we need to do so in a way that protects economically vulnerable Medicare beneficiaries. Now, the median or typical income level of someone on Medicare is about $25,000. So the idea that you would ask them, as the Ryan budget does, to reach 10 years down the road, by the way, but as the Ryan budget ultimately does, to reach into their pocket and spend more on their own health care is not at all realistic. That doesn't mean that Medicare shouldn't be on the table and that some very wealthy beneficiaries, for example, shouldn't contribute more. I think they should. But the idea that you're going to kind of shift the burden of health care costs onto people, that's just a shift. That's not a savings. One more point. In fact, we have, by dint of some improvements, many of which were amplified by the Affordable Care Act, slowed the growth of Medicare and Medicaid spending significantly. In fact, about $500 billion over the next 10 years have been taken off of the growth forecast because of recent progress in that area. So we're actually slowly moving in the right direction, but we need to do more of that.
Michael Tanner, the Ryan budget includes a Medicare voucher for those under 55. Is that something you support?
Well, I think he's making a step in the right direction. One of the things we should realize is that both the president's budget proposals, we don't have a current budget proposal, but assuming his more recent ones, and the Ryan budget actually target the same future growth rate of Medicare spending, which is about GDP plus 1%. I think that's too high on both sides, but they both have exactly the same target. Essentially, the president wants to reduce spending from the top down, sort of command and control, and primarily by squeezing further reimbursements to providers. He argues that that doesn't cut services to beneficiaries. I would suggest you can't pay doctors 50 cents on the dollar and have them still provide those services. That in the long run, you're just indirectly rationing care. Ryan wants to ration care from the bottom up, in effect, by having seniors bear more of the cost themselves and do basically self-rationing in the sense that they are price rationing in the sense that they'll decide more what they want to pay for. Both are going to reduce Medicare spending by about the same amount. It's just a question of whether you do that down from the top down, command and control, or from the bottom up with consumers making decisions for themselves.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation on that point as well. That's Michael Tanner. He's a senior fellow with the Cato Institute, architect of the Cato's Project on Social Security Choice. Also with us, Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Spent a couple of years working in the Obama administration for Vice President Joe Biden. We're talking about the budget. We're talking about taxes, spending. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. It will never please the public, said Tchaikovsky of his Fifth Symphony, yet its melodies have captivated for over a century. Andre Boryeko leads the Philadelphia Orchestra as they perform Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Tchaikovsky tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
A great record producer is like an alchemist, turning lead into gold. This week on Sound Opinions, we've got one of the greatest.
I wanted to work with people who were really keen to make the recording studio a wizard's laboratory, just making magic.
Tune in to Sound Opinions for our interview with longtime David Bowie collaborator Tony Visconti, plus a review of Bowie's new album.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about some dueling budget proposals in Washington and finding out if there is common ground. Again, talking with Michael Tanner and Jared Bernstein and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jared, let me go back to you and even put Ryan's budget under the microscope. He talks about balancing the budget by eliminating parts of the Affordable Care Act. He talks about overhauling Medicare, cutting social programs. What's your response to that?
I'm very critical of that budget. I think it's really very badly drawn and misleadingly characterized. For example, one of the things that kind of irks me the most about it is that he argues in his budget for about $6 trillion, these are 10-year numbers, of tax cuts, largely benefiting folks at the upper end of the income scale. But he's reducing taxes by $6 trillion. Now, there's no way you're going to balance the budget with that kind of a huge tax cut. So what does he say? Well, I'm going to offset those tax cuts by closing a bunch of loopholes. Yet he neglects to specify even one loophole. And by the way, if you closed all the loopholes, and Michael and I know that that's never going to happen politically, you still wouldn't be able to make up that difference. So that's one problem. My second problem is about two-thirds of his $5 trillion of spending cuts come from low-income programs. So this is Robin Hood in reverse. I mean, you're cutting food stamps and Medicaid and educational opportunity at the low end, critical programs for people these days who need that kind of help. And you're turning around and you're delivering that in tax cuts for wealthy people. So it's a very upside-down, misleading piece of work.
Do you see it that way, Michael Tanner?
Well, I've sort of had my criticisms from the other side of this. I think that, first of all, this really doesn't cut spending. Federal spending would grow by 3.5% a year under this budget. This is not a spending cuts bill. It only reduces spending when you look at it in a Washington way that says that any reduction from the baseline of growth is going to be a cut, but it doesn't really cut spending. And in fact, as a percentage of GDP, he never gets federal spending down below 19%. So we would still, under the Ryan budget, at the end of the day, have spending as a higher percentage of government than under Bill Clinton. This is just another example for me of Clinton nostalgia.
Coming from a Republican
than Bill Clinton had.
Well, can I respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry. Yes.
Look. This argument that I hear a lot from Michael and others like that are that we're not cutting spending, we're only cutting spending relative to some growth path, strikes me as an extremely strange argument in the following sense. Year over year, the population grows. Year over year, nowadays, the population grows in such a way that we're going to have a third more elderly people over the next 10 years. How could we possibly, even if we wanted to cut the heck out of Social Security and Medicare, with those demographic pressures, how could we possibly spend less on Medicare and Social Security, and not to mention the safety net programs I was mentioning, and still provide any kind of recognizable level of services to people? Now, where Michael and I might agree is that if you want those services, you have to pay for them. Mm-hmm. So I think what's going wrong is government says to people, you can have everything and pay nothing for it. That's obviously wrong. But the idea that they're not cutting because things are growing, you have to pay attention to population growth, demographic growth, baby boomers, et cetera.
Well, and even picking up on that, Michael,
sure.
Oftentimes when you see even protests or callers to this show, one of the comments is I think now a very famous sign, you know, get the government hands off my Social Security or my Medicare. People like this stuff, whether they want to pay for it or not.
Oh, absolutely. One of the problems with cutting spending is that one person's wasteful government spending is another person's program that they depend on. And the fact is there is no way to reduce spending without inflicting a certain amount of pain. But if you look at Congressional Budget Office projections, they suggest that by the middle of the century, federal government will be consuming 43% of GDP. Throw in state and local governments, and you're up over 60% of GDP being consumed by the government. You can't have a sustainable economy with government consuming that huge proportion of the economy. You are going to have to reduce spending as a percentage of GDP somewhere along the line. Now, we can argue about what programs should be cut, what one shouldn't. I would suggest that most government programs don't actually do a great deal of good, but that's an argument we should have. The idea that we can simply spend as much as we want as long as we raise taxes enough to pay for it. You can't raise taxes enough to get there.
Well,
so that number.
No, go ahead, Jared.
That number that Michael's citing of such a large percent of government spending is almost completely driven by healthcare costs. And everyone who looks at the budget agrees that that is unsustainable. So really, if you look at every other advanced economy who spends about a half to two thirds of what we do on healthcare, we're going to have to adopt those policies. Or Michael's right. We're facing unsustainable pressures. But that's well known, and that's really a different issue than the Ryan budget versus the Murray budget.
But picking up on that, Jared, I mean, that's an argument for raising taxes.
Correct. So here I think taxes have to go up, and that's because of what I said earlier. I think the problem in this debate is politicians have convinced people that you can have X value of things that you want, but you only have to pay one-third of X to get it or something like that, you know? And that's, of course, wrong. What we have to have is an honest national discussion, sort of gets at something you said earlier, Marty. If people want what they say they want, retirement security through Social Security, through Medicare, that means we're going to have to collect the tax revenues necessary to pay for it. Now, that can't get up to 30 and 40%. I agree with Michael. That's unsustainable. But that is not a matter of tax policy. That's a matter of slowing the growth of healthcare costs. And if we don't do that, the private sector is even more screwed than the public one. So that, to me, is a separate issue.
Why is the private sector more screwed?
Because prices of healthcare are growing faster in the private sector than they are in the public sector. So when you say down the road everything looks terrible, what you're saying is healthcare is growing too fast. But that's actually even a bigger problem for American businesses and corporations because their healthcare spending is growing even faster on a year-over-year basis than the public sector. And importantly, public sector healthcare spending has slowed over the last few years. So once we factor that into those forecasts, they won't look quite so grim.
Michael, let me ask you, you're at Cato, a libertarian organization. So what do you see as the basic responsibilities of the of government?
Well, I think it depends on the level of government. But I think at the federal level, I mean, the government's basic job is to protect the life, liberties, and properties of individuals. That means government should adjudicate disputes. It should mount a defense, which is not defense of the world, the defense of the U.S. And it should undertake those things in our society that, by virtue of their scale, can't be done by civil society, that is, individuals and the private sector and private charities and so on. But government doesn't do a very good job, I think, of trying to basically intervene in people's lives, whether that's financially or morally or educationally.
But if a hurricane, you know, blows in, as Sandy did along the East Coast, is it? Do you think it's government's responsibility to help out communities or help out governors, for instance?
Well, I think that certainly arguably that something of that massive scale is something that government can get involved in. On the other hand, if you're simply moving money around today, we're taking the money from Louisiana and giving it to New Jersey. Tomorrow we can take it from New Jersey and we give it to Louisiana, and we do so inefficiently. We're not necessarily making the situation better.
But do you think, Jared,
Go ahead. I think the thing about Sandy or these storms blowing in, I'm not sure exactly where Michael was, but I think I agree that there's a role for government there. That stuff is absolutely tiny, minuscule on the scale of what really has to do with our budget pressures. What I found interesting listening to Michael was I thought when he was going through his litany of what he thought government should do from a Cato libertarian perspective, to my ears, retirement security actually fit in there. So at least the way I was listening to him, Social Security and Medicare, which are, in fact, particularly the latter, the big drivers of budget pressures moving forward, legitimate because these are folks who are past their working lives, and the marketplace, the private marketplace, will not efficiently provide retirement and health care security to people who are past their working lives.
Is that what you meant, Michael?
Well, on retirement, I would disagree with that strongly. I think the private sector can do a much better job of providing retirement security than this those pyramid scheme that we call Social Security. That said, on health care, I think there's more of a debate, but I would suggest that the government health care programs are a large part of the problem. The Medicare, whether or not it's cheaper, depends a lot on when you start counting from, what years you start counting from.
No,
but Medicare,
really,
in many ways, is essentially a basic, old-fashioned, fee-for-service health care system that is remarkably inefficient in the way it pays for health care.
Well, go ahead, Jared. I know you want to.
Okay. So we have a disagreement on numbers once again. And I'll be happy to post charts on my blog later, jaredbernsteinblog.com, which show long term. Comparisons between price growth and Medicare in the private sector, and Michael, I believe Michael's just flat wrong about that point. But look, I think he has a very good point about inefficiencies in healthcare delivery, which, again, because of the price numbers I just cited, are demonstrably worse in the private side than they are in the public side. But that means that we have to implement the kinds of delivery mechanisms that have been helping. Now, some of them, again, are in the Affordable Care Act. Things like bundling services so that when you go in, you don't have a multiplicity of services that you don't need, duplications, things like incentivizing hospitals to lower readmissions, which have actually been great. I'll put a graph on that up lately. It's actually been helping a lot.
Yeah, those kinds of things worked well.
Yeah, so those kinds of things are what I'm thinking of.
Go ahead, Michael. What did you just say?
No, I was going to say that's one area where I think the Obama administration deserves some credit, is particularly on that readmissions issue where they have been quite effective.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Michael Tanner. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, architect of the Cato's Project on Social Security Choice. He writes a weekly column for National Review Online, also a contributing columnist for the New York Post. Also with us, Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities from 2009 to 2011. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, also executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about the middle class, but let me get a couple of callers in. Looks like we have Christine from Levittown, Pennsylvania. Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for taking my call,
Marty. You're very
welcome. This question is for Michael. If you have these vouchers covering all the Part A and Part B Medicare costs, is the voucher program going to be progressive in the sense that those at the low income scale will get a bigger voucher than those at the high income scale because they have less money to spend for any extras?
Christine, let me give Michael Tanner a chance to respond. Michael?
Yeah, as envisioned, the way I understand that Paul Ryan envisions this is not the way I would design this, but the way he envisions it is that within a geographic area, insurance companies would bid on how much that it would take for them to offer the same basic package of services as Medicare provides. The voucher that you would receive would be equal to the amount that the second lowest bidder, what their bid is. So if you had, let's say, three in the area, one bid for $800 a month, one at $1,000 a month, one at $1,500 a month, you would get a voucher for the $1,000 a month. And if you then wanted to buy the $800 plan, you could keep the $200. If you wanted to buy the $1,500 plan, you'd have to put in $500 of your own money. All the plans would cover roughly the same basic package of services that Medicare provides today.
Let me ask you something. Jared Bernstein, Michael Tanner talked about I think it was both Social Security or Medicare, but certainly Social Security as a pyramid scheme. Do you see it that way?
Oh,
is it a pyramid scheme?
No, not at all. And I think that's a deeply misleading characterization. In fact, I was shaking my head vigorously no when Michael was holding forth, because Social Security is actually a far more efficient pension system, it's just a public pension system, than anything the private sector has to offer, particularly if you look at, say, the administrative costs. Obviously, it's nonprofit. It's a highly efficient program. This pyramid scheme notion completely belies the funding mechanisms that have been built into Social Security from the beginning that have contributed to its success and its efficiency over the years. I mean, one of the reasons this is a popular program is because it works. Now, because of demographic pressures, we need to do what I think, you know, pretty much everyone who's looked at this, with the exception of Michael, it's not that he doesn't know a lot about the program. He does. It's just that he looks at it very differently than right. I do. And most others. Most people, including the Congressional Budget Office, have looked at this and argued that there are a number of what I would call relatively minor tweaks that could be made to achieve actuarial balance over 75 years, which is kind of the goal of Social Security financing. I could give you three or four right now that would
give us one.
Okay. Increasing the amount of tax that's subject to the payroll tax. Because of the increase in earnings inequality, we used to tax 90% of earnings, but now we only tax about 84% of earnings because there's so much more earnings over the cap. Once you earn more than about $110,000, you're not paying Social Security taxes anymore. So by increasing that cap, which would be a fair and progressive idea, you could reduce about a third of the shortfall over the next 75 years.
Michael Tanner, why do you say Ponzi scheme and not insurance policy? Why do you see it that way?
Sure. Well, because it is simply a transfer program from workers to retirees. There's no savings that takes place in Social Security. There's no investment that takes place in Social Security. It simply takes money from people who are working today and gives it to people who are retired today. Now, that works very well when you have a handful of retirees and a lot of workers. The problem is that the number of workers is shrinking and the number of retirees is increasing, and that puts an ever greater burden on workers. So just like a pyramid scheme, ultimately breaks down when you can't get enough workers or get enough money out of the workers in order to support those retirees. Now, I would disagree on that raising the cap. I mean, not on just a fairness or an income raise, although we've already done that for the Medicare tax. We're doing it for a number of other taxes. There has to be a limit to how much blood you can get out of a stone. The problem is that you just don't get that much from it. The numbers that Jared was talking about, one-third, has to do with the sort of trust fund accounting, which I think is basically a myth. If you want to look at cash flow accounting, you could remove that cap completely, tax everything above the current cap, and you'd increase this cash flow solvency of Social Security by 7 years. So you don't get a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah. We have fundamental disagreements about the numbers here. I mean, first of all, the idea that today's workers can't pay for tomorrow's retirees are belied by all the analysis that shows, as I mentioned earlier, that the shortfall could be closed with relatively minor changes like the one I mentioned. And by the way, the thing that Michael's leaving out of his analysis is the fact that, of course, today's workforce is far more productive than yesterday's, and tomorrow's will be even more so. So as each worker is more productive, it's that it affords us more resources to finance this retirement process, which I agree with him, is very much a transfer between today's workers and tomorrow's retirees, and a very elegant one, because remember, it's tomorrow's retirees that left the economy and the workforce and the productivity that I just mentioned to today's workforce. So it's a very elegant intergenerational program.
And that's Jared Bernstein, who joins us along with Michael Tanner. We're talking about a whole host of things, including government spending, Medicare, Medicaid. We didn't actually talk about Medicare, Social Security, government spending, taxes, and more. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. After this short break, we'll be talking about the middle class. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network, offering access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
On the next Fresh Air, parenting a baby doomed to die soon. We talk with Emily Rapp. Her new memoir is about her son, who, at the age of 9 months, was diagnosed with Tay-Sachs disease. a genetic disorder which leads to dementia, seizures, spasticity, blindness, paralysis, and eventually death. He died last month before reaching his third birthday. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The intellectual disabilities rights movement is about a struggle that began more than 60 years ago. It's about respect, independence, and services. A new play in the making brings the history of the movement to life, highlighting trauma, resolve, and the milestone successes of parents and their kids. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, we look at the ID rights movement as a work in progress. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, transforminghealth.org, an interactive online resource offering a comprehensive look at the changing landscape of healthcare in America and right here in Pennsylvania. Videos, blogs, and success stories are available at transforminghealth.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with the Cato Institute's Michael Tanner and Jared Bernstein from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Sarah from Drexel Hill has to say. Sarah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Great. I think it's really important that as a society that we psychologically more proactively move from what we think of as creating economy of war to economy of peace. And I think I would certainly maintain that defense contractor lobbyists are a piece of pushing huge budget in terms of the military expenditures over the years. I think in 2010 there was it was 59% of the budget was in military expenditures, including all kinds of other aspects of that. But my question
not
is
sure about that, but
why
yeah.
is it so difficult to focus on job creation for infrastructure, sustainable energy jobs, perhaps FDR type of strategy? I mean, why is this so impossible to achieve?
Well, Sarah, let me take your point, actually, and toss it. I'm going to toss that first to you, Michael Tanner.
Well, I'm going to quibble a little bit with the numbers. I think defense spending is about 19% of the federal budget. If you throw in some of the things that are sort of defense-related, Homeland Security, you might get that up to 23-24%. But it's about it. Now I think we should dramatically reduce that. Don't get me wrong. I think we've spent way too much more on the defense than we should. One of the important things to think about, though, when we talk about federal spending, is how little of that really is investment. The president talks a lot about investment. Even if you use a very broad-based definition of investment to include things like education, which is sort of a human investing in human resources, only about 13% of the federal budget is actually investment. The vast majority of it is simply transfer payments, that is taking money from person A and giving it to person B.
Well, picking up, Jared, Sarah really raises some questions about infrastructure and the green economy. I mean, do you see that as a responsibility of government?
To some extent, I do. I agree with Michael's numbers, by the way, on defense. But let me say one thing about defense. I mean, I like Sarah's view of an economy. I mean, I think many of us prefer peace over war. I think the problem is, you know, you've got people like me and Michael who are talking about the defense, and Sarah to some extent, talking about the defense budget from like 30 or 40,000 feet up. What we really need to figure this one out is experts on geopolitics, war, and the government's role therein. My view from studying those experts is that our approach to the military is really kind of out of sync with what we need, and we probably could reduce costs significantly. But the idea, you know, we have 11 aircraft carriers. I think the next nation with the most aircraft carriers has one. So it's, you know, it seems like there's sort of obvious things we could do. But I'd really like to bring in folks who think about that a lot more granularly. On Sarah's point and your question about should we be doing more on the jobs front, you mentioned infrastructure, green jobs. Certainly infrastructure is key. I mean, there are public goods. Every economist, probably even Michael, would agree that when it comes to public infrastructure, roads, bridges, water systems, airports, there are so many productive parts of our economy that are deteriorating that no private firm has the responsibility for. Now, money is cheap right now because interest rates are low. There's still lots of unemployment. It does seem like a really natural time to kind of marry the problem of our deteriorating infrastructure with our difficult economic situation.
Do you agree with that, Michael?
I'm not that far off of it. I mean, I would argue a little bit on the deterioration. We keep hearing about the deterioration. You actually look at the number of substandard roads and bridges. They've actually been declining. So I'm not sure if we really are deteriorating the way we think.
Well, I invite you to take a trip around Pennsylvania, but nonetheless, go ahead,
yeah,
Michael.
There are places worse than others, I'm sure.
Yes.
But I would, I would agree that infrastructure, basic infrastructure, is something that's a legitimate function of government and is something you might want to look at putting money in. I do think on all government spending, though, you have to look at both sides of the equation. What the French economist Frédéric Bastiat talked about is the seen and the unseen 150 years ago. He spoke of the fact, for example, take a French farmer, let's say this was the 1900 or 1800s. He said, take a French farmer who's planning to dig a ditch to irrigate his fields. He's going to hire a bunch of workers to go dig that ditch. But along comes the French government and taxes him, takes that money that he was going to use to dig his ditch, and instead uses it to repair a road later on. Everybody sees the workers that are hired to fix the road and says, gee, isn't the French government doing a wonderful job? What they don't see is all the people who no longer are going to be hired to dig that ditch and the fact that that farmer's crops are now going to wither in the field and so on. You have to look at both sides of the equation.
But are you saying that because our government spends so much money that is literally crowding out businesses, that businesses are just panting and waiting in the wings because they want to build roads, for instance?
No. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't spend money on building roads. I'm just suggesting that there is no such thing as a free lunch, that whenever government spends money, it is taking money out of the private sector in some way, which is limiting then economic growth on that side of the equation.
Well,
I think you've got to balance these things.
Go ahead. Sure.
Interestingly, the private sector, particularly the corporate sector, has never been more flush. So there's certainly no evidence for the Bastiat effect that Michael's talking about. Now, corporate profitability as a share of national income is higher than it's ever been, while compensation, paychecks, is at a 50-year low. It's well known that corporate America is sitting on literally trillions of dollars of investment income that they're not putting to work, and in no small part because I think the underlying economy is still too sloggy.
And are they putting that money in the stock market that just keeps climbing and climbing, Jared?
Right. I mean, well, that's where a lot of the profitability comes from. In other words, if you're a multinational corporation, how the American economy is doing is of somewhat secondary importance to you. You have the ability to shop capital markets and consumer demand across the whole globe. And that's a real source of both corporate profitability and the increase in the current stock market.
Jared, let me ask you, because you were executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, as we know, the middle class is being squeezed more and more. People have frankly become poor in the last couple of years. There are, of course, working poor as well. What do you think this country and this economy can do to help the middle class and frankly help people get out of poverty?
Well, that's interesting. Michael mentioned earlier this idea of investment in people. I think it's clear that a ladder out of poverty for folks who start out in disadvantaged circumstances, education is key. And I think in many cases their communities are failing them. And the part of the budget that we started out talking about budgets.
Yes.
The part of the budget that supports that kind of investment in kids is the part that, frankly, everybody, whether it's the White House, Democrats in the Senate, but particularly House Republicans, are cutting the heck out of. It's called domestic discretionary spending. That part of the budget is taking a real hit. So if we want to help kids climb out of poverty, we have to think more about the Pell Grant program. We have to make sure that is adequate, something that Paul Ryan goes after. We have to make sure Head Start is in place. And boy, I really like the president's idea of preschool programs for kids, particularly really focusing on kids below 200% of poverty. The middle class is somewhat of a different story. I think that has a lot more to do with job growth, pushing back on some of the difficult aspects of globalization, and making sure health care is accessible and affordable for them.
And I do want to get back to our callers, but Michael Tanner, from your perspective, how does this country deal with our problem of poverty, and growing poverty?
You know, I think poverty education is a key to getting out of poverty. I think it's the number one solution to poverty has to do with education. But where I would disagree is I don't see any evidence that suggests that more government spending yields better education. We've been spending more year after year on education in this country, and yet we're not seeing any increase in test scores. And even if you want to look at something like Head Start, even the GAO reports and others suggest that Head Start doesn't do a very good job. In fact, outside of two very small and almost impossible to replicate studies, there is no long-term gain from Head Start. That's completely gone by third grade. Anything that's been put in there.
Well, again, we have.
Yeah, I'll give you a chance, Sarah. No, go ahead, Michael.
You've got like these two small, but they were very, they were something that could never be replicated on a large scale simply because the amount of money.
I disagree with that characterization, but as opposed to dueling studies, let me say this, and maybe this will tweak Michael a little bit towards my side. There's a guy by the name of James Heckman. He's very well known, Nobel laureate economist, and very much associated, I would argue, with a lot of the kinds of positions that Michael has staked out. But on this issue, he has been incredibly strong on suggesting that, in fact, the money that the government has spent, and by the way, not every dollar is perfect. Michael definitely has a point. But he takes his point way too far. If you look at the work of James Heckman, a conservative Nobel laureate economist, he will tell you that not only has Head Start been successful, but the idea of investing in universal pre-K, as the president has suggested, is a hugely important economic investment that would return far more than it would cost over the life of these kids. And we now have evidence in support of that.
Well, we'll have to have you back on to debate this particular issue. But let me get some more callers in. We have Mark from looks like Phoenixville joining us on Radio Times. And Mark, go ahead. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. My question relates to a comment made earlier that somehow there's a magic percent of GDP that's unsustainable. I've been listening to this debate for years, and I've not heard any credible evidence for that argument. Could either speaker set a limit?
Sure.
I think that's a great point. I think Mark is really... This is Jared.
Yes, go ahead.
My position gave me away. I think Mark makes a tremendously important point. Now, it's easy to say that if government, collected and spent, 40, 50, 60% of revenue, it just sounds unsustainable and crazy because historically we've collected something like 18% on average and spent 20 or 21%. So, economists are always looking in the rearview mirror and looking at averages and saying, well, based on averages, that's crazy. But Mark has a point. There are lots of European countries who collect and spend 30 and 40% of their GDP and seem very happy about it. So in many ways, it's a national discussion, a decision that has to be made. What we can't do, and I think Mark and Michael and I would all agree, is spend 30% and collect 10%, because that's just unsustainable. But Mark raises a great point.
Yeah, Michael, should we start thinking like French people?
Well, I don't know that France has seen tremendous economic growth. It certainly has high unemployment rates and a number of other things. Look, I think you can look at studies by Robert Barrow of Harvard, who finds that there's a negative relation between GDP growth and government share of GDP, that if public consumption goes up, economic growth goes down. There's studies by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, numerous studies that show that there isn't a magic number that says 30 is fine, 31 and you're tipped over.
Right.
But at some point along that level, you eventually get to a point at which government becomes too big a weight for the economy to handle.
Well, I don't disagree. Let me just say,
Go ahead, Jared.
I don't disagree, although there's conflicting research. But I don't disagree where Michael is coming from. I guess the one thing I would say is that, and here the research is very solid, what you really cannot find, is evidence that says if you raise taxes on the wealthy or the middle class, for that matter, a little bit, everything falls apart. And I do think that that mis- leading notion is really cramping this debate, along with this idea of, you know, you can't go beyond X percent. So I think that Mark has a point, but I think that Michael has a point, too, that there's a limit.
Mark, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you both about something, and I apologize to our guests that, our callers that we won't get on the air, but this has to do with the tax code and closing loopholes and all of that. And Michael Tanner, do you favor some kind of, a tax code reform?
Massive. I think our tax code is a disgrace. It is unfair. It is economically distorting. We spend far more time companies trying to take advantage of loopholes in the tax code than in production. I mean, we distort all sorts of economic decision making by the way we have. We should have a much flatter, much simpler tax code. Mm. As far as whether or not it raises revenue, I'm not going to stick, a fork or a line in the sand to say, oh my God, there's $1 of additional revenue, that's bad. But I think that the goal here needs to continue to look at the idea of what are we spending, and if we're spending too much, we need to bring that down. There's not enough money out there from taxing the rich or closing loopholes to pay for all the projected future spending. If you confiscated every penny owned by every millionaire and billionaire in America, you wouldn't pay off the national debt.
Well, and no one is suggesting that we do that. But
yeah,
let me.
I don't think we've ever done that.
But no. Let me go back to you, Jared. And we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here. But it seems coming from the Democrats, the idea is to close some of these loopholes and thereby raising revenue to help defray some of the costs of government.
Well, it's not just Democrats. It was a few months ago that Republican leader John Boehner suggested we could raise $800 billion in revenue by closing loopholes. Paul Ryan has consistently talked about that. Candidate Governor Romney talked about that. So, Michael and I agree on that. Everybody seems to agree on it, but we agree at 40,000 feet. The minute you say, well, what about this loophole? Someone says, whoa, that's my job program, not a loophole. So the president has suggested a good idea to get around that, which is to just cap deductions that people take in the tax code at the very high end. Instead of taking that deduction at 40 cents on the dollar, take it at something like 25 cents on the dollar. And that's a good way to sort of cut out all of this fighting about my loophole over yours.
Well, to be continued. Jared Bernstein, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And Michael Tanner, thank you very much as well.
With a pleasure.
And Michael Tanner, senior fellow with the Cato Institute, architect of the Cato's Project on Social Security Choice. Jared Bernstein spent a couple of years in the Obama administration as an economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. He's currently a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, the archives. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming up next, a conversation with Judy Wicks about her life and her philosophy about socially responsible business. She opened the White Dog Cafe in West Philadelphia 30 years ago. She's